All right, thanks, everybody. Please have a seat. Looks like we have a fairly full quorum today, and as a result of that, I'm going to ask just a couple of things extra. First, it has come to our attention that if you use the wireless function on your mobile devices, that somehow interferes with our audio recording system. This would just kind of like an airplane. I'm not exactly sure why, but that happens. So if you could please not use your wireless function on whatever devices that you have, we would appreciate that. And specifically, that means don't email, don't blog, don't tweet, that kinds of things from the portal. Other than that, of course, you can use your electronic devices as you wish. Well, the second thing is, we have an awful lot of people in the courtroom, so if you could just respect our need to be able to hear what we're saying, we would appreciate that. So, let's get started. This case is called Taxpayers for Public Education versus the Douglas County School District. May I have the entry of appearances? Starting with you, sir.
Good afternoon. Michael McCarthy and Colin Beal with Gregory Baker Daniels appearing on behalf of the taxpayer and the Warner claims.
All right.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Matt Douglas and Tim McDonald with Arnold Porter appearing on behalf of the Warner claims.
Okay. Now, I take it since you both stood up that you both want to talk a little during today's hearing or no?
Thank you, Your Honor. We do. What we've agreed to is that we will divide 30 minutes with Mr. Douglas and I, each taking 12 minutes, reserving 6 for rebuttal. As we did in the Court of Appeals, I will address the school finance issues. Mr. Douglas will address the religion issues.
Okay. You'll need to keep track of your own time, and that's reasonably easy to do so because the numbers kept going. We'll start on the other side of the room. Mr. Lyons.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. James Lyons and Eric Hall. Firm of Lewis, Roker, Rothgerber on behalf of the defendants.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Michael Bindis and Tim Keller from the Institute for Justice. We represent the intervening responding families.
Mr. Bindis, thank you. And will both of you be addressing the court?
Yes, Your Honor. I'm going to take the bulk of the time to try and reserve about 5 minutes for Mr. Bindis.
Okay, well, we just reiterate, sir, you need to keep track of your own time.
Yes, sir.
So this is a one-hour case. That is to say that each side has 30 minutes to decide how to use as you wish. And with that, let's get started. Mr. McCarthy.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. The Douglas County School Voucher Program violates the Colorado Public School Finance Act. Because, as the trial court found, and as we have presented to this court, that program is dependent for its implementation on a charter school, called the Choice Charter School in the papers that have come before this court, that is invalid under both the Charter School Act and the Public School Finance Act. There has been no meaningful substantive response to the invalidity that we have identified in the charter school that is used by Douglas County to implement their school voucher program. It is invalid because it violates 3 of the 4 definitional requirements for a charter school. That being the charter school under the statute needs to be public, which this program, when looking at where these children are actually educated, it is not. It must be non-sectarian, which it is not. It must be non-religious, which it is not. And it must be home-based. So only one out of those 4 definitional requirements under the Public School Finance Act, as it incorporates that definition from the Charter School Act, only one is satisfied. Any one of those failing satisfaction causes the charter school to be invalid, and the program therefore fails. And I emphasize that it is important to look at the substance of whether the voucher recipients are actually educated as opposed to the charter school, because the charter school is a mirage. What the record shows without any dispute is that this charter school has no classrooms, it has no principal, it has no textbook, it is a mirage. It is little more than a
a false front from an old Western movie. And what is really happening here is that the voucher recipients are, in truth and fact, being educated at the private partner schools. And the money that is coming from the Douglas County School Board is going directly to those private partner schools. Now, what necessarily is presented by the papers the court has seen is the allegation and the finding by the Court of Appeals that in terms of that statutory claim that we make, a violation of the Public School Finance Act, there is not standing on behalf of our clients to assert that claim. So I turn now to address the statutory standing question because constitutional claim standing has not been challenged. The statutory claim here was found not to be one that could be asserted by the plaintiffs because according to the Court of Appeals opinion, there was no legislative intent under this court's jurisprudence to allow for a private claim, a claim for enforcement of the Public School Finance Act. What the Court of Appeals relied upon almost exclusively in concluding that there was no standing was the rules and regulations. And what this court has seen from the briefing is that there is little more in the actual School Finance Act other than a broad authorization for the Department of Education to promulgate rules and regulations. Based merely on that authorization to promulgate rules and regulations, what the Court of Appeals found was that there was no legislative intent to allow for a private claim. What we submit to the court is that, and its silence really is what we would point to, the effective silence to foreclose a private cause of action is not adequate under this court's jurisprudence. But more importantly, and something that I think was alluded to but not adequately developed under the brief, goes to the rules and regulations themselves, because they are critical in the Court of Appeals' conclusion that there was not standing. And I implore the court to actually look at the rules and regulations that the Court of Appeals relied upon to foreclose standing here. And those regulations can be found at 1 CCR 301-39, 2.01 and following. Those are regulations of the State Board of Education. The majority of the Court of Appeals said, because of those rules and regulations, you have no private cause of action. I believe that when the court looks closely at those actual rules and regulations, what you will see is there is nothing there that addresses the sort of situation that we were confronted with when Douglas County adopted the public school voucher program. There is nothing in those rules and regulations that addresses what we have here, which is in truth and fact the export of, in this case, $3 million that was headed out of the Douglas School District and into the hands of private parties. In a way, the program presses the limits of many of
Let me ask you this. So there are plenty of state statutes, and you're familiar with the environmental area, natural resources, for example, where our state statutes don't have a private cause of action, but the federal statutes do. Now, I'm going to ask you this, and you'd have to say there's not a private cause of action built into the School Finance Act, because, I mean, there's no clear avenue to bring a citizen suit, for example.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, so what's the difference between that and standing that you're asserting, and what is the interest, what is the injury that allows citizens to challenge the setting up of this charter school and the financing through it?
Your Honor, the injury here is the depletion of a limited fund of monies that come to these schools from the state in order to fund public education. And it is the most basic premise in both the constitutional provisions that you see in Article 9 and the Public School Finance Act, which is that public school funds are intended to pay for public education. The analogy, and I know Your Honor has
There's deep experience in the environmental and natural resources area. There's really nothing comparable, I think, once if you actually take a look at these regulations, 2.01 in particular, which is the enforcement provision here, there's nothing comparable to what you see in the federal structure or even in the state structure as far as creating some kind of an adequate remedy to prevent the export of millions of dollars out of this, out of the Douglas County school budget. In some ways, the program was...
Maybe does the State Board of Education have standing to do that?
Well, the state, that's what the majority for the Court of Appeals said, was that not so much standing, but this falls within the exclusive province of the State Board of Education. Two responses to that. First, if you look at 2.01, which is the only enforcement mechanism that exists under these statutes, the only mechanism that exists there is a mechanism that speaks to broad noncompliance with the school financing, nothing more specific than that. And the remedy is in a sense almost overkill, because what the remedy is suspension of accreditation of the entire school district if there is noncompliance with the statute. But it is a process that unfolds, as you can see, over months before that determination is reached. And here we have immediate outflow of funds, and here's the significant part of it in particular, Your Honor, that I think, because this goes to both a rightness issue that was raised in the case, but also to standing. There's been some discussion here about what's called a clawback provision, which is that, well, if this money was somehow wrongfully paid to Douglas County, because these, in fact, were private schools, these students back into private schools, you could claw the money back. There's nothing in the statute that gives the Department of Education any jurisdiction over the private partner schools into whose hands this money will flow. So the clawback provision is designed to require Douglas County to give the monies back. But what, in this case, is different than anything contemplated by these regulations.
Also, does any citizen of the state of Colorado have standing then to bring this suit?
I would say not, Your Honor.
Who does?
The students and parents in the Douglas County School District. Because it is they who are going to be impacted by the depletion of the monies that they would otherwise be entitled to, but which under this program are being exported to private schools with no obligation from those private schools to pay that money back. And so those are the individuals that have standing. Your Honor, the other point that we've raised, there's some controversy about this in the briefs, is the fact that we have what I think is fair to characterize under the record as the school board enabling Douglas County. The record made very clear that there was extensive cooperation between Douglas County and the state board, which was supposed to be the enforcer here. And in fact, representatives of the state board, and they admitted this under oath at the preliminary injunction hearing, expressed their belief that this was a valid program and they were going to do everything within their power to make sure that this program was approved. So if the basis for saying that there's no standing here is because these regulations are an adequate remedy, but what in fact we get is a deaf ear hearing. If what we get is the administrative agency who's supposed to stand at arm's length and be the enforcer of the School Finance Act has already expressed, before they even saw the program, an inclination to approve the program, the enforcement power means nothing. Because we have a compromised enforcer here. And I urge the court, if I was to point to anything in the record in particular to use this oral argument to do this, I would implore the court to look at Trial Exhibit 65. Trial Exhibit 65 is a very short email that was sent by a person who was at that point in time the chairman of the State Board of Education, expressing that person's clear belief that everything was to be done that was possible to accelerate the approval of this program, and also Mr. Hammond's testimony in the trial.
Well, what is that, a sort of backup surrogate standing? If those who are supposed to enforce it don't, then the parents get to do it?
And Your Honor, the short answer to that question, I think, is yes. I think if the grounds for denying standing is that there's an adequate enforcement mechanism under the statute, but under these circumstances, we have proved on the record that the enforcer is compromised, then if we go back to the case that we've emphasized so much in our papers, which is Allstate against Parfrey, and you look at this court's opinion in Allstate against Parfrey, the touchstone for standing is substantial frustration. Those were the exact words that this court used, substantial frustration of a central purpose of the act. And if the enforcer is not going to enforce, if the Department of Education is going to abdicate its responsibility to enforce these provisions, then those regulations cannot be a basis on which to deny standing. So I have two other...
I'm sorry. Well, I was just going to say, can you respond to the allegation that it's going to result in a parade of horribles, that there'll be countless lawsuits if we open the door to private enforcement in the way that you're suggesting?
Your Honor, the response to that argument is that in none of those programs, none of the parade of horribles were the subject of this case. We are here, and this court functions, as I have always understood it, on a case or controversy basis. You hit them as they're pitched. And there is nothing in the record, nothing, that adequately develops what the facts and circumstances are of those programs that would enable a legitimate argument to be made that if you strike down this voucher program, it's going to have a cascading effect. And so, Your Honor, it's in trial evidence, it might be Rule 403, these are programs which were simply not developed on the record, and you can't argue for an attack upon the trial court's rulings because it's going to have these implications. The only testimony that spoke to these programs, Your Honor, came from Senator King in the preliminary injunction hearing, and that was nothing more than naming the programs and saying what they did. That doesn't even come close to becoming a foundation upon which this court could decide the case, to say that because this voucher program is invalid, it's going to ripple out through the state and invalidate this case, and I'm confident this court will decide this case on these facts. And we have, Your Honor, we think compelling facts here. We have a situation both in terms of the invalidity, I'm out of time actually, and in terms of the Article 9, Section 3 Public Lands Trust, where what we're asking the court to do is to enforce the plain meaning. The plain meaning.
Of what?
The plain meaning of the Constitution, Your Honor, Article 9, Section 3, as this court interpreted the Lance Trust in the Brodlin case, the plain meaning of the School Finance Act, not to engage in the kind of de jure allocation of funds that you saw the Court of Appeals do when we saw that opinion and say, well, we're going to kind of just segregate those funds. This court said in Brodlin that the Public Lands Trust has an absolute prohibition on having those funds be used for anything other than public education. I'm sure I've risked Mr. Douglas's ire at this point. I'm way over. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Mr. McCarthy. Mr. Douglas?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm going to speak quickly now in order to save 6 minutes for rebuttal, which is our plan. Your Honor, following on what Mr. McCarthy just said, it's a nice segue, that under the religion clauses of the Colorado Constitution, the primary issue is a plain language issue. Does the Colorado Constitution mean what it says? There is a direct and clear constitutional command in the No Aid Clause that says specifically that school districts cannot pay any money to any school controlled by any church or sectarian denomination whatsoever. This court has held that when the language is plain, it's meaning clear, and there's no absurdity involved, constitutional provisions must be declared and enforced as written.
And so, keeping in mind that plain language, how do you explain our ruling in Americans United, which obviously didn't adhere to the plain text of that provision?
Your Honor, this court's decision in Americans United did not reach the key constitutional questions that are presented by the facts before the court in this case, specifically on Article 9, Section 7, the No Aid Clause. This court deferred ruling on whether, if facts demonstrate that money was actually going to schools that were, in fact, controlled by churches and sectarian denominations,
whether that was in violation of the no aid clause. That the court actually reversed a summary judgment ruling in favor of Regents College on that issue because it found that it did not have facts before it in order to determine whether money was going to a school that was so controlled. Here, we have overwhelming factual evidence, undisputed factual evidence, that these schools are controlled by churches and sectarian denominations. So on the key question, this court did not reach that question in this decision in Americans United. And that's the question here. So it is a question of first impression for the court, an as-applied challenge to 23 schools, the vast majority of which the evidence showed were in fact controlled by churches and sectarian denominations. The defendants try to get around the plain language of the no aid clause by saying this is a program of neutral private choice, and that somehow excuses the violation of the plain language. But in order to make that argument, they rely on establishment clause cases. But this is not an establishment clause case. And in fact, the establishment clause does not have a clear and direct command like the no aid clause. And when you look at the context of the decisions by the U.S. Supreme Court in funding religious schools, what they found is that neutrality and private choice remove the government endorsement of the funding of the religious program at issue. But the no aid clause in Colorado is not about government endorsement. It's about a specific prohibition on government payment of funds to schools that are controlled. So whether something is permissible under the establishment clause may be able to be established under current jurisprudence by an unusual program of genuine private choice. But there's no exception in the no aid clause for aid to prohibited schools that's done in a neutral way involving genuine private choice. Another issue that Americans United did not reach is the issue of whether sectarian tenets can be taught to public school students in violation of Article 9, Section 8, the prohibition against teaching of sectarian tenets. And that's largely because that college grant program did not use the vehicle of a charter school to funnel public school funds to private schools. Furthermore, here, back to Article 9, Section 7, we have specific evidence in this case that this money is in fact aiding and supporting these schools. That's evidence that was not present in the Americans United decision. Specifically, Mr. Gerke, head of one of the schools that was undisputedly controlled by the church, testified that the reason his school participated in the voucher program was to deal with a debt crisis that was threatening the viability of the school. And in fact, his school's enrollment increased 10% through the program specifically. And this is a pilot program in Douglas County. So here, we have specific evidence that the money is aiding and supporting the schools. That was not present when the facial challenge was decided in Americans United. It's also important to note that there is no intrusive test needed to apply the plain language of the Colorado Constitution as written, and specifically the no aid clause. Those determinations and evaluations of whether something is religious, those are constitutionally permissible, and they are conducted in a wide variety of contexts, including application of religious tax exemptions, unemployment exemptions, and religious discrimination exemptions. Those have been upheld repeatedly by both state and federal courts. This court upheld a detailed inquiry into whether property was being used exclusively for religious worship and reflection. Let me ask you, under the plain language of that provision in the Constitution, could it be possible to have a payments to schools that are private but not sectarian? No religious agenda, no affiliation, just a hypothetical one. What does that language actually say in the Constitution?
The no aid clause of Article 9, Section 7 says any school controlled by any church or sectarian denomination whatsoever. So if it is not controlled by a church or sectarian denomination, but it's nevertheless a private school, that would not violate Article 9.
So is it possible to have a voucher program for independent, private, non-sectarian schools under your reading?
Under Article 9, Section 7, No 8 Clause, yes. There may be issues under the Public School Finance Act that may not be cured by that. There is a program in Maine that was upheld by the First Circuit in the Hewlett case, which is a funding of private education that excludes all sectarian schools. And so that has been held to be constitutional in Maine. Whether it would be all the different constitutional provisions here at issue or the Public School Finance Act, given the charter school, maybe another question, but under Article 9, Section 7, yes, that makes sense. Another example of the application of an evaluation of something as religious is the Third Circuit's decision in 2007, looking in detail at whether a Jewish community center was a religious corporation, association, or society. And in doing so, evaluating whether Title VII exemption for religious discrimination would apply to that Jewish community center. And upholding that. Defendants have also made much of the voluntary nature of the program, curing some of the constitutional violations. But, Your Honor, all charter schools are voluntary, and no charter school can provide religious education. This is essentially a charter school that students enroll in, and then they're presented with a menu of options, and they choose one. Almost all of them are religious options. And the fact that the charter school is voluntary does not cure the fact that charter schools have to be non-sectarian and have to comply with the provisions of the Constitution prohibiting religious tests on admission, teaching religious tenets to public school students, and mandatory attendance at religious services. Your Honor, parents are free to choose religious education for their children. But under the plain language of the Colorado Constitution, public taxpayer money cannot fund that choice. Your Honor, we'd like to reserve the rest of our time for the public.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's see, Mr. Lyons.
Thank you, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice, may it please the court and counsel. As I said, we're going to reserve 5 minutes for Mr. Bindis. Let me start with the constitutional religious issues. There are two principles and two questions this court has to ask. First, is this program that gives aid designed to aid the student? That was the central test of Americans United. That's how this court interpreted the language of Article 9, Section 7. There's no reason for this court to deviate from that. However, the second question that the court needs to ask is, who decides where this state money goes? Is the state making the decision in the form of the school board, or is it parents who are making the choice? Because the federal jurisprudence here is clear. If it's parents making the choice, the link is, quote, broken. And that's the Locke case that we cited in our papers. Plaintiffs have argued that the First Amendment jurisprudence of the federal courts, particularly the Supreme Court of the United States, are not determinative here, citing Americans United. But what they don't cite from Americans United is the next phrase, not necessarily determinative, but cannot be totally divorced. And that's found in your opinion at page 1078. So, in our mind, the analytical framework for this starts with Americans United from 1982, and then looks to the federal jurisprudence in the school choice area, which has developed since 1982. There are three cases, we cited more, but there are three that are particularly instructive here. They are Mitchell, they are Zelman, and they are Locke. Coming back just for a moment to the benefit question, plaintiffs also point out in their papers that is one of several factors that are looked at by this court in deciding Americans United, and that's true. There are other factors that are identified. But the central question, is the aid designed to benefit the student, is the essence of your opinion in Americans United. You said it not once,
page 1081, not twice, page 1082, but a third time, page 1083. Now, if you start with that, then you move to the second question. Who makes the decision? And in this case, parents make the decision. Let's start with those three cases I mentioned, the Mitchell case from 2000. And I'll take the plurality opinion, as you know. I will take the concurring opinion of Justice O'Connor, citing Witter, 478 U.S. 488. She says, quote, the fact that aid goes to individuals means the decision to support religious education is made by the individual, not the state. 2 years later in Zelma, which dealt with the tuition aid program in Cleveland, the Supreme Court said, quote, this court's jurisprudence makes clear that a government aid program is not readily subject to challenge under the Establishment Clause if it is neutral with respect to religion and provides assistance directly to a broad class of citizens who in turn direct government aid to religious schools wholly as a result of their own independent private choice. Citing, by the way, Mueller v. Allen, which is 463 U.S. 388. And last but not least, there's the Locke v. Davey case. This is the case out of the state of Washington dealing with a program that allowed public funds to be used except for theological programs. This is a case that the Supreme Court talks about the play in the joints between the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. That's the case where Chief Justice Rehnquist says clearly, quote, the link between government funds and religious training is broken by individual and private choice of recipients. It's exactly what we have here. So, taking Americans United and your interpretation of what the EA clause means, meaning is it designed, being a neutral program, to benefit the student? You then look to the federal jurisprudence to account for the significance, in our view, the determinative significance of parental choice. This program, the Choice Scholarship Program of Douglas County, was found by both the trial court at page 39 and 44 of its opinion and the Court of Appeals at page 38 and 49 of its opinion to benefit the student. That question, as a finding of fact, is closed. Parental choice, as I said, breaks the link.
What do you do with the plain language of the Constitution, which, you know, going back to the founding days and then for a century after that, had a clear demarcation between free public education and the choice of parents to send their kids to religious schools? And it was always understood for generations that if you wanted your kid to go to a religious school, you paid your taxes to keep the public schools going. And then you also then made the family choice, the individual choice, to provide that kind of education. So how about the implications of what the founders really intended with respect to free, universal, public education and its ability to survive this avenue to take funding that's necessary to fund classrooms and teachers and quality education and curriculum and divert it away from public education?
Well, a couple answers to that, Justice Hobbs. First of all, federal jurisprudence has changed. Choice didn't exist 100 years ago or 150 years ago. I'm not going to get into the
plain nature of the state constitution here.
All right. Well,
and the commitment of taxpayer dollars,
right,
through that constitution.
There is not a nickel from this program that is being diverted from any other school district as found in the Court of Appeals. This is money that parents choose to take with them. If they choose not to take with them, they stay in the Douglas County school system, which, by all accounts in the record, is a very fine and good school system. They are simply being given the choice here to take state money that is, or public money that is available to them, and use it as they see fit. And as the Supreme Court says, that breaks the link. Now, in terms of where these amendments come from, as we briefed, these are Blaine amendments. These are plain and simple Blaine amendments. And Justice Thomas, writing for the plurality in Mitchell, described them exactly what they are. They were born of bigotry, and they deserve to be buried. So am I asking you to overturn them?
No.
But I am asking you to take into account the origin and pedigree of these amendments as a matter of legislative intent, if you will.
One of the founders intended that in fact there'll be viable schools in each of these districts. The only way to do that was to be sure that money stayed for that purpose. I mean, well, here's don't you think that in addition to whatever side effects or prejudices people had at that time, that there's in the written language, there is a good public purpose there that in fact is going to be diminished if some parents or more parents or majority of parents split away from the Douglas County Public Schools to take this money. What happens to our free public school system?
But they're actually, Your Honor, taking less money with them than they would otherwise be entitled to have if they stayed in the Douglas County school system. Think about the arithmetic for a minute. If the per pupil revenue every year is hypothetically $6,700, as it was, I think, at the time of our trial, and 75% of that is subject to the program, a pilot program, by the way, that was enjoined before it could be implemented. If 75% of that money is then given to a parent in the program to make the choice, there's 25% left behind for administrative costs. If there was no program, or if a parent elected not to participate in the program, they're not taking money that isn't theirs anyway. There is no diminution of the resources for a free and public education. No.
Mr. Woods, may I ask you a question? Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
If I'm understanding your argument right, you're almost saying that there's just a paradigm shift in how we look at education, and particularly public education, and that public education is no longer like what Justice Hobbs was suggesting, is every other, it's just the schools that you can go to for free. Now what you're saying is public education is almost a funding mechanism that will give you money, you the public, you parents of students money, and then you can use that to choose how you want to use that money to buy education. Is that a fair?
Not exactly.
All right, help me with that, because it seems exactly. You're suggesting almost this paradigm shift of what public is.
Well,
help me with that.
There's clearly been a shift in the jurisprudence in the 30 right. years since this court decided Americans United. There's also been significant changes in education and how it's delivered. Going back 150 years, I mean, it was all little red schoolhouses located right down the street in the same township so it could be funded by property tax and some help on backfill from the state. That's gone. That's been gone for a long time. The founders never could have considered things like, and did, charter schools, which are perfectly legal and valid. How about online schooling? How about homeschooling? How about the whole digital revolution? All of that has contributed, as the record reflects, to the decision of this board in its discretion and exercising its authority under its constitutional authority under local control to offer a pilot program.
Perhaps I can come at my question a little bit different way to save a little time. In your mind, is public education now that entire panoply of choice? Any kind of educational choice, is that now a public education?
I don't think necessarily. I mean, to just
it's not necessarily everything is public. Under your theory, what no longer is a public education?
Well, it would be exactly as Justice Hobbs asked me. If I choose, as I did, to send my kids to private religious schools, I paid for that. I also paid my taxes for the local school district to support the public school system.
What is no longer public? If I'm given the money and I want to send my daughter to a school, an Episcopalian school, let's say, is that now a public school?
No.
Why not?
Because your daughter, in that circumstance, is a public student electing to attend, at your election or hers, electing to attend a private school.
Sure. Now, if we looked at Douglas County, and Douglas County gave me some money, and I decided to use that money to send my daughter to the same Episcopalian school, would that be a free public education? Would that be a public education?
Well,
in part
it would be, because I don't think your stipend is probably going to cover the total tuition.
Sure.
So you're going to have to
public,
come out.
That would be a public education. So what you're saying is all education now is public education as long as we get the parents the money and they can exercise their choice as to how they want to buy or choose their education. Is that right?
Well, let me try it a little different. I'm trying to be responsive. The effort here is for Douglas County to continue to provide the high quality of education to those students in its public institutions who choose to use it. And I think pretty clear they do a good job. They have decided in their discretion, which they have under the School Finance Act and within the state constitutional provisions for local control, to offer a pilot program to see if the quality of the education they offer throughout the district can be improved by competition. That was the testimony of Mr. Carson, president of the school board at the time. So what happens here is your daughter living in Douglas County is a public school student. If she qualifies and participates in the Choice Scholarship Program, she gets a stipend, public money, which she can use privately. That's what's changed. But it hasn't affected the responsibility of the school district to provide a full and free, fair public education for those who choose not to be in the program. And it doesn't diminish by a nickel the school system's ability to do that.
All right, thank you.
Let me just take a moment on that. A couple of other issues. Mr. McCarthy talked about there being a violation of the Charter School Act here. I would suggest to you that it's a red herring. The trial testimony was the charter school was formed here mostly as an administrative convenience so that the students who are part of this program could be tracked by Douglas County in terms of their performance, their curriculum, their requirement for state testing, and the like. Are there other ways to do it? Probably. But that's the way that they chose. And that was their discretion and their right. The charter school here is public because it deals with public students who are making a private choice. It is clearly non-sectarian and non-religious. This program is entirely neutral when it comes to religion.
I guess the question is how is it even a school as opposed to just a transfer agent?
Well, first of all, there's a broad definition of what is a school under the Charter School Act. And it embraces, for example, the fact that Douglas County, as do some other school districts, have online programs that are administered by the school district through a charter school mechanism. So it's an administrative convenience. Could it be done another way with school coding or some other way of tracking these students? Probably. But that's up to Douglas County to decide. Point one. Point two, this whole attack on the charter schools was not made until this court was developed at the trial court, was raised at the Court of Appeals. It's being presented to you for the first time. There's no record for support of this. And your jurisprudence is pretty clear that you don't consider issues first raised on appeal in this courtroom. With regard to standing, let's set aside for a moment the first prong of Wimberly and just look at the second one. They rely, which is that there's an implied right of action. That's their only answer to your question, Justice Hobbs. There is no implied right of action here. Take the Parfrey case. Parfrey implied a right of action for an individual insurer to sue an insurance company, not to sue the government. And to make it even clearer, this court said in Parfrey, citing Magnus, quote, There is no legislative intent, to imply a private request of action where administrative remedies, rules and regulations exist to enforce the act. That's precisely the case here. There are a number of opportunities for the Colorado Department of Education to enforce this act, but you have to keep in mind, they were enjoined, like we were, from going forward with the program. So they've not had an opportunity to fund the program, to consider whether they're going to fund the program. They've not had an opportunity to audit the program, which they have the right to do, and they do have the right to claw it back. Now, who do they claw it back from?
Excuse me, if I might interrupt you again, but it seems to me, though, that the record reflects that the department was acting, at least in concert, with the district in order to set this program up. And so to the extent the parents are saying, if that's the enforcing body, and the enforcing body is complicit in this program, and yet there seems to be perhaps, at least there's arguably a challenge to that, who else could possibly have standing except the students and parents of students who would be affected?
Well, I think you can start with the proposition that there is not a private right of action for every governmental action that's taken.
express or implied. Let's at least start with that. Secondly, the Department of Education had no opportunity yet to do its job. Yes, they were consulted on several occasions as this program was being developed. There's no question about that. But that doesn't make them complicit. They're simply doing their job. With a school district that comes to them and says, we'd like to do this. You're the Department of Education. You're our funding mechanism.
Well,
we want to make sure you're satisfied.
There's certainly no indication, correct me if I'm wrong, but there doesn't seem to be any indication from the department that they had any problems with the way this was set up.
No, but as I say, this program was enjoined in August. The headcount day for schools is in October. Mm-hmm. The ability to audit it comes at the end of the headcount. And after the audit, the ability to claw it back comes in the first part of the following year. None of that was allowed to happen. So for the plaintiffs to argue that the enforcement mechanisms are not adequate strikes me as a little inconsistent with the fact that they enjoined the Colorado Department of Education from even using them. And that's the state of the record at the moment. With regard to an argument that's been made about Article 9, Section 3, the school trust, I think one way to look at that, and it may be a bad example, is sort of like Social Security. The school trust funds are in a lockbox. And that's to keep them from use by the legislature or the executive branch for any other purpose, transportation, prisons, whatever else the state needs to fund. The beneficiary of the funds in that lockbox are the school districts. That's what Article 9, Section 3 says. Once those funds come out, then the school district has constitutional authority under local control, has statutory discretion under the School Finance Act to use those funds. We'll also make the argument, as we did in our papers, that like any trust, when the money leaves the trust and goes to the beneficiary, it's no longer burdened by the trust. But we're not grasping our
hands. I thought the whole thing was ceding those two sections of every township or whatever it is. Maybe it's vice versa. You know. And the In Loon Lands was a dedication by the federal government for the perpetual support of the public schools. Isn't that what it says?
And they are. And they are.
Well, that goes back to the chief's question about whether we really have public schools here.
Again, Justice Hobbs, these are public school students who are being given a private choice to use, frankly, less money than they otherwise would get the benefit of if they stayed in the public school system and elect a private option with no adverse effect on anyone anywhere else, either in Douglas County or any of the other 190-some-odd school districts around the country. So maybe one way to look at it is it's back to the central thrust of Americans United. Who benefits here? Who is this designed to benefit? Well, in the case of the Article 9, Section 3, it's the school districts that are designed to be benefited. And after that, our Constitution is pretty clear, and our statutes are pretty clear. It's up to the school district how to use those monies. As far as the 2%, that this really accounts for. I mean, the Court of Appeals made a couple of suggestions as to how that could be dealt with. You can either include it in the 25% that's retained, or you can regard the 98% that is funded as not including the 2%. I think that misses the point to some extent, although we were successful in the Court of Appeals, so I'm hesitant to be too critical. The fact of the matter is, I think the lockbox analysis of this money and who is the beneficiary and how they're entitled to use it pretty much settles the question. So let me say two things and then give the rest of my time to Mr. Bindis. First of all, as I said, this is a pilot program that was enjoined in 2001, literally on the eve of the school year. The program was interrupted. We were in the process, as the record shows, of talking to any number of private schools, religious and non-religious, and we were enjoined from going forward. Required to get the money back, as a matter of fact, to get the money back. The school, the Choice Scholarship Program in Douglas County, to your question, Justice, does impact dozens of other programs in this state, thousands of other students who participate in programs which have a very fundamental common ground. They all use public money at private schools.
And we've set them all out in our brief, pages 6 through 9 and 10 of our answer brief. And they range from preschool programs to K-12 programs. Denver, for example, has contracted with as many as 3 private schools to provide and meet its obligation for public education. And of course, at the higher education level, we have the Colorado Opportunity Fund, which gives a stipend to students to use wherever they choose at whatever institution of higher education they choose. All of those programs will be thrown into chaos, and certainly at a minimum placed in jeopardy, if this court decides to reinterpret American genetic and to ignore, as the plaintiffs would have you do, the federal jurisprudence that's developed in the choice area, and only look at 3, Mitchell, Zelman, and Locke. I'd like to give the remainder of my time, unless there are any further questions, I'd like to give the remainder of my time 7 minutes for Mr. Bindis.
Well, maybe so, Mr. Lyons. Mr. Bindis, you have 7 minutes and 8 seconds.
Try to make the most of it, Your Honor. May it please the court. Petitioner's interpretation of the state religion provisions would violate the federal constitution's command of neutrality toward religion. A long line of cases, from Everson to Lacoon to Rosenberger to Mitchell, make clear that singling out religion for unfavorable treatment, including excluding religious options from student aid programs, is impermissible under the First Amendment. Fortunately, this court can avoid that federal constitutional problem very simply, by simply holding, as it already did in Americans United, that religious options alongside non-religious options are perfectly permissible in student aid.
Well, we have to do a certain amount of surgery on the Colorado Constitution to accomplish what you're suggesting, of it, don't we?
Not at all, Your Honor.
Why is that?
Your Honor, with respect to the no-aid provision, speaks to programs, or not programs, to funding to aid religious institutions. As Mr. Lyons said, we demonstrated this program aids students. This would be, to accept the petitioner's argument, would be akin to saying that Medicaid is a program designed to aid doctors and hospitals. No, it's a program designed to aid people with medical needs. Douglas Hammond Scholarship Program is a program designed to help people with educational needs. So that would require no surgery to get state constitutional provisions, Your Honor. As this court recognized in Americans United, the hallmark of the federal constitution is neutrality toward religion. And for that reason, the court has repeatedly made clear that government cannot exclude religion from educational aid programs that are otherwise neutral and generally available. For example, Everson versus Board of Education. The court held that to exclude members of any faith because of their faith or lack of it from receiving the benefits of public welfare legislation would violate the free exercise clause. More recently, the four justice plurality that Mr. Lyons mentioned in Mitchell versus Helms, the court explained that the court's jurisprudence, quote, prohibits governments from discriminating in the distribution of public benefits based upon religious status. Yet that is precisely what Colorado's religion provisions would do if interpreted as petitioners suggest. Now, in addition to that free exercise problem, there's another significant problem here, and that is the equal protection problem. Because as the Supreme Court held in Romer versus Evans and striking down the Colorado constitutional provision, the equal protection clause prohibits government from making it more difficult for one class of citizens than for all others to seek aid from the government, especially when that disadvantage was born of animosity. Again, if interpreted as petitioners suggest, Colorado's religion provisions would do exactly that. They would make it more difficult, in fact, impossible, for parents who desire a religious education for their children to seek aid from their government. And moreover, that disadvantage will have been born of animosity.
Can I, if you don't mind, if I'm going to interrupt you, I'm struggling a little bit with the angle at which your argument is coming from, because it seems to suggest almost that Douglas is, in fact, affirmatively required to fund this type of program. And am I misunderstanding your position?
With all due respect, yes, Your Honor. We're not at all suggesting that government is compelled to fund private options. Government absolutely may do so, but government can permissively draw distinctions between public and private. The government may not draw distinctions between religious and non-religious.
Right, so under that theory, the point would be if Douglas were to implement a voucher program and only apply it to non-sectarian schools, that could be a problem. In other words, to exclude religious schools from the voucher program. But that's not the situation here. I mean, the question would be, you're not suggesting that Douglas is affirmatively required to enact or implement a voucher program, are you?
No, Your Honor.
So it could choose to do nothing, and that would be not a problem.
Correct, Your Honor. However, when government chooses, and there's no question that under the federal constitution, Douglas County is perfectly within its realm to adopt this program. When government does choose to provide this type of public benefit, it's clear from Edison, from Lacuni, from Rosenberger, from Mitchell, that it has to do so even-handedly with respect to religion.
And in that sense, you're saying the Section 7 provision cannot come into play to draw distinctions between private and religious schools?
Well, Your Honor, Section 7, first of all, doesn't speak to programs that aid students, which is what this program is. It was intended to, its purpose was, and its impact initially was to preserve, as we've, and back upon mentioned in our briefs, the kind of religious, generic religious nature of the public schools at the time, and prevent government funding of Catholic schools, institutional aid to Catholic schools. That's what that provision was meant by the framers to do. Now, putting aside whether that's permissible or not, that's not what's going on here. This is a program designed to aid students, to help Douglas County families achieve the best education for their children. And Douglas County has seen fit to provide a broad array of options, religious and non-religious. They include some of the things that Mr. Lyons mentioned: charter schools, contract schools, home educational opportunities, option schools, open enrollment, magnet schools, and the Choice Scholarship Program. This is one option among many that Douglas County provides families so that they can get the best education to meet the unique and individualized needs of their children. It's hardly surprising, given these federal constitutional problems that I've mentioned, that the 10th Circuit, as well as the 4th, 6th, and 8th, have all held religious exclusions from educational aid programs impermissible under either the both the Exercise Clause and the Equal Protection Clause. Fortunately, as I mentioned at the beginning, this court can and should avoid these problems. It just has to simply take the very prudent approach that the Court of Appeals took, to interpret the state provisions as requiring the same neutrality as the federal provisions, and allowing religious options alongside non-religious options in student aid programs. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Bendis. Counsel?
Thank you, Your Honor. We're going to try to do a quick change here. The invalidity of the charter school under the statute is key here, and the factual foundation in the record to establish the invalidity of the charter school, the fact that it wasn't, that it was sectarian, that it was religious, that it was private, that foundation is established by this court can confirm that factual foundation by looking at the testimony that you will find in the record for Mr. Carson, who was the chairman of the school board, Ms. Selenia Fagan, who was the superintendent, Mr. Cutter. I implore this court to look. We cross-examined those individuals at trial, and we established from them under oath that this school, this so-called charter school, had no classrooms, it had no books, and in fact, it was exactly what Chief Justice Rice called it. It was no more than a transfer agent. It was an artifice. And without that artifice, Douglas County can't claim this money. And that's the key point here. The reason why they created this charter school, but they created it just as a transfer agent, was so that they could say that these students, who were in fact pupils at Valley Christian or Regent or Regents or Mullen, some of the well-known and respected private institutions in this community, that they were students in those schools. They said, no, they really weren't. turn a blind eye to this. What they really were they were students of this charter school that had no classrooms, that had no books, that had no principal, and that goes back to what the central funding mechanism is, and it is pupil count. And unless they could claim these students as part of the pupil count, they couldn't claim the money. And that's the critical point here, Your Honor. And if the charter school is invalid because it is, when you look at where these children are actually being educated, it's sectarian, it's private, it's religious, because that's where they were in fact going to school, then the charter school collapses and the whole program collapses.
Mr. McCarthy, I'm over here.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. But isn't that for the State Board of Education to make that determination that it's a sham? Isn't that the whole point? Is that they can come in and say that, no, you're just creating this to get our money?
Your Honor, this goes back to the point that I made in my earlier argument. I believe Justice Marquez alluded to this. What we have established, and what a big part of what we were showing in the trial court, Your Honor, was the fact that the Department of Education had already pre-decided this. They had already concluded not only that this program was okay, but that they were going to do everything they possibly could to make sure that it would be approved. And the one thing I will also add to that, Your Honor, the procedural context. This money was already going out the door. At the time we had our preliminary injunction hearing, $200,000 had already been paid over to private schools. And so by the time the Department of Education, even if they were going to wash away everything they in fact said on the record and start from scratch, the money would, you know, the money would already be in the hands of the private schools, and it would be beyond the clawback power of the Department of Education to get it back.
But it's their job to do that, yes or no? You just don't think they're going to do it.
They said they weren't going to do it, Your Honor, with all due respect.
But ultimately, my question is that's their responsibility, ultimately. You're just saying they're not going to live up to that responsibility, correct?
It's their responsibility if they have the tools to do it. And that's an important qualification, Your Honor, because it goes back to the regulations. And the regulations that the Court of Appeals relied upon, they just don't speak to this kind of a situation because it's so audacious. Because it's like an ultra vires act. And it is really beyond anything. If you look at those rights, it's beyond anything that those rights contemplate. So in a sense, it's not something that the regs say that they have to do because it's not addressed in the regulations. That's the best answer I think I can give you, right?
Thank you.
I'm almost out, but I'll turn it over to you.
Sure. Mr. Douglas.
Thank you, Your Honor. Oh, we're getting low on time. First of all, the federal First Amendment issues that were discussed by Mr. Bindis have been squarely rejected by the federal courts. The U.S. Supreme Court in Locke and the First Circuit in Hewlett squarely rejected the precise argument that Mr. Bindis made under both the Free Exercise and Equal Protection Clause in the context of exclusion of religious education from a funding program. Said that it may be permissible to fund those under the First Amendment, but state constitutions can, in fact, exclude religion and religious education, and that's exactly what we have here. So that falls then back to, it's not really aid to the student. First of all, the facts before this court show that that's not the case. The Arizona and Florida courts that struck down voucher programs there said it well in that it may be aid to the student, but it's also material aid to the institution. That's what the facts show here. Mr. Lyons also said that was the central thrust of the American United decision, was it was not aid to the student. If that were the case, this court would not have had to reserve the question of whether there might be a violation of Section 7 if Regis College is in fact controlled. Because if it were enough to say, well, this isn't aid to the institution, this court could have stopped there, but it didn't. It reserved that question because there could be a violation even if aid is designed to go to the student. And the link that they say is broken is, again, First Amendment jurisprudence. It breaks the link of government enforcement. It does not. Choice and neutrality do not break any link in Article 9, Section 7. The First Amendment is 10 words long. I apologize.
I'm sorry, thank you. I have to stop you. All right. This case has been argued very ably by all councilmen, from Mr. McCarthy, Mr. Douglas, Mr. Lyons, and then Mr. Bendis. The case will be submitted and...